What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
An important announcement. As you will hear in the podcast, I'm screening my documentary, Commie Camp, about the legendary summer camp, Camp Kinderland, which was founded by socialists in 1923 and still exists to this day, on Wednesday, October 4th at DCTV in Manhattan at 87 Lafayette Street. Now, the 6:30 showtime sold out, so we added an additional 9 p.m. screening. So please buy your tickets before these sell out as well. And to do that, you go to the DCTV website. That's dctvny.org/s/firehousecinema and scroll down to Commie Camp or click on the calendar link. Again, that's dctvny.org/s/firehousecinema. And just so you know, Medea Benjamin calls it a delightful documentary. Susan Sarandon calls it so much fun. Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson calls it a warm, funny, and delightful film. Writer Vivian Gornick calls it a thoroughly engaging and charming documentary, one of those rare films that is as hilarious as it is informative. Filmmaker Tammy Gold says, "I found myself laughing, identifying, and crying all at once." Commie Camp is a celebration of love and resistance. Basil Hamden, Michael Moore's longtime collaborator and the executive producer of Fahrenheit 11/9, calls Commie Camp fascinating and timely and a much-needed dose of hope and humor. So don't forget to get your tickets and see you at the movies. Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. And welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm so excited to be here with you. We have an amazing show today. We will be talking to presidential candidate Marianne Williamson about her race, about politics, about the state of the world, about what it takes to get media coverage when you're running against Joe Biden. Then after we chat with Marianne, we're going to be talking with Lev Galinkin, a Ukrainian-American journalist, and he's going to be talking to us about Canada's very interesting Ukrainian Nazi problem. So make sure you stick around for that. That'll be after our chat with Marianne Williamson. Please do like the stream. Make sure you like the stream. Hit the like, hit the share, hit the subscribe. To subscribe, you press subscribe and then the bell. That helps grow the channel. Make sure you do that. Also, if you can, you can join us at Patreon, patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. You get way more content than you get if you don't join Patreon. If you can join just at the $1 a month level, that is great. That helps make the show happen. And if you want that extra content, that's the $5 a month level. And again, you just do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. So if you're watching this stream live, you're in luck. You get to see the whole stream. If you're watching the stream later and you want to see the full stream with Marianne Williamson, as well as the full stream with Lev Galinkin, then you will be able to do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Now, before I bring on Marianne, a very exciting announcement. A documentary that I made called Commie Camp is going to be screening in New York City. And Commie Camp is about Camp Kinderland. It's a camp that I attended as well as my mom and grandmother, as you'll see in the trailer that I'm about to play. And Kinderland was founded in 1923, which means that it is celebrating its 100-year anniversary. So I'm releasing the film to celebrate that date. And we're going to show you a trailer of the film right now. This is Camp Kinderland. I went to Camp Kinderland, and so did my mom and my grandmother. I love Camp Kinderland. But not everyone does. For some people, it's
a politically left-wing Jewish summer camp with communist roots. They walk in there as young skulls full of mush, and the liberal establishments at these places bend and shape their mind.
One of the very, very special things that camp is known for is for its
progressive propaganda agenda.
This is the sun, which, is, as you can see, is a peace sign.
Stop indoctrinating my children.
Do you think as kids you can make a difference?
If you just stop littering.
Going to anti-war demonstrations with your parents.
In my school, we saved an orangutan.
Get your kids out of this indoctrination.
We love camp.
Our republic will be lost.
If we wouldn't go there, we would be lost.
In order to save the children and the republic, there's only one thing for me to do. I'm going back to camp.
I know the word for cream cheese.
Okay. Ready?
Schmear.
This girl wrote a letter under my bed.
Please do tell me, is that right?
That said somebody has a crush on you.
No more!
It's garbage, 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 garbage!
We're sort of in love.
Well, today was really fun. I had a really good time. I hope for the other days it's going to be a lot funner. That would be amazing.
One.
And that is Comic Camp, and that will be playing on October 4th, Wednesday, October 4th, in New York City at DCTV, at the DCTV Firehouse, which is a really cool actual landmark location that used to be a firehouse. And it's at 87 Lafayette Street in Manhattan, so downtown Manhattan. And then if you're not in the tri-state area, if you're in the tri-state area, get yourself to that screening. We'll put a link in the description. It'll be fun and funny. Susan Sarandon has blurbed the film. Medea Benjamin has blurbed the film. Oscar nominee Josh Olson, nominated for an Oscar for his screenplay for A History of Violence. He also has blurbed the film. All positive things, obviously. Basil Hamden, Michael Moore's executive producer on Fahrenheit 9/11, has blurbed it. So lots of cool people like the film, if I do say so myself. So make sure you come out to that. And if you can't catch it then shortly thereafter, it will be for sale online at YouTube. So let's see. Without further ado, actually with some further ado, because let me just read to you, share with you some of the biography of the guest I'm about to bring on, and then we'll actually bring her on. All right. So Marianne Williamson is a political activist, author, non-denominational spiritual lecturer, and New York Times bestselling author. Her career began in the 1980s, during which time she became deeply involved with HIV/AIDS activism. A longtime champion for the LGBTQ+ community, she founded Project Angel Food to deliver meals to the homebound, unable to shop or cook for themselves. To date, the charitable organization has served over 16 million meals. She also founded the LA Center for Living, the Manhattan Center for Living, and co-founded the Peace Alliance. In 2020, she ran for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States and is now a candidate challenging the candidacies of President Biden and Robert F. J. Kennedy. As an essential part of her platform, Williamson proposes a 21st century economic bill of rights, a Department of Peace, reparations for slavery, a Department of Children and Youth, and a just transition from a dirty to clean economy. A progressive Democrat, Williamson proposes a new economic beginning, including universal health care, tuition-free college, and tech school, and a guaranteed living wage. So without any further ado, let us bring on Marianne Williamson. Hi, Marianne. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, Katie, and congratulations about that documentary. That looks so cool. And I had no idea you were a documentarian. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. My mom went there. I went there. And it still exists. That's the other cool thing about it, is it still exists. And if I have kids, I will also send them there.
I understand why.
Yeah. And the kids are adorable, too. So, Marianne, let's see. A lot to talk about. Let's start off with your domestic program. Let's start off with your transition for majority to a clean economy. What does that mean?
Well, we need to declare a climate emergency. We need to make a World War II level mass mobilization from a dirty economy to a clean economy, a just transition. We need to cancel immediately the Willow Project. Right now, the president is giving more oil drilling permits even than Trump did. This is not a time to be ramping up fossil fuel extraction. It's time to be ramping down fossil fuel extraction. Let's also remember that the U.S. defense establishment is the single largest institutional emitter of greenhouse gases. So even though there are some healthy investments in green energy in the Inflation Reduction Act, they are completely nullified by the investments we're making in dirty. In other words, it's not enough to just say we're going to invest in green if, on the other hand, you're also investing in so much fossil fuel extraction, the old energy grid, that you're basically nullifying the benefits of anything else. It's time to just declare a climate emergency and get about the work. And I think that the American people in really being educated about this would be more than willing to embrace what this actually means, not only in terms of the weather, not only in terms of the air, the habitability of the planet, possibly over the next few decades, but also in terms of job creation. You know, a lot of the jobs that now go towards fossil fuel extraction, even at least indirectly, have to do with technology, manufacturing, research. Many of these moves will be lateral. You know, I've had people come up to me and say, Ms. Williamson, I'm making over $100,000 a year on a job that you think is the kind of job that we need to phase out of. Are you telling me that you want me to go work for $15 an hour to put up solar panels? Well, the answer is no, actually, because this can be strategized, this can be mobilized, this can be organized. And that man who spoke to me is exactly the type of person who should not and would not under my administration fall through the cracks. But we have to make this transition. And I think that like so many things in our society today, the change is going to come. The issue is, are you going to make the change wisely and willingly, or is it going to be thrust upon you? And I fear for my country, and in many ways I fear for the world, if we are so unwise as to allow these changes to simply be thrust upon us.
So what kind of things would happen after a climate emergency were declared?
Well, the issue of a climate emergency is that the president has the power to override certain things that otherwise you wouldn't. One of my favorite stories about Franklin Roosevelt is when Franklin Roosevelt, you know, at the beginning of World War II, once Roosevelt knew we needed to get in, that the free world was at stake here, the U.S. basically had nothing to speak of in terms of military power, and Britain had nothing. Meanwhile, Hitler had been building up his military for 5 years, and every time he invaded a country, he was able to absorb their military capacity. So Franklin Roosevelt needs tanks, and he needs ships, and he needs planes. So he calls in the big three. The same is what's going on in Detroit right now, right? That big three. So he calls the big three into his office in Washington, and he says, gentlemen, I need this many ships, and I need this many tanks, and I need this many planes. And the answers of the big three, the big industrialists in Detroit, were, President Roosevelt, sir, we are patriotic Americans. We will get you those planes. We will get you those ships. We will get you those planes and those tanks. As soon as we have sold our quota of cars, we'll be right at it, sir. And Franklin Roosevelt famously said, gentlemen, I don't think you heard quite what I said. I need this many tanks. I need this many ships. I need this many planes. You will not make another car until I get them. That's what it means for the president to declare an emergency. It means that that emergency overrides all other commercial factors. Now, don't get me wrong. Roosevelt knew that he couldn't achieve any of this without partnering with the great industrial powers of the time, because they were not going to not make profits. He had to form partnerships. And of course, we want that as well. The fossil fuel companies, this is the thing. Not only have they known the damage for decades, it's now well established. Not only have they known the damage that they were doing, but they also know it's over. They know it's over. They just want to squeeze every last dollar out before they are forced to make the transition, that a declaration of a climate emergency would simply be the president of the United States saying it is not acceptable, it is not tolerable. And on behalf of the people of the United States, I'm saying it will not happen anymore. We are moving forward. And if you don't do it willingly, the powers granted me by the declaration of this emergency will mean that you will have to.
So another question that's related to, of course, climate is the question of auto workers and cars and technology. Tell us what your plans are for instance, the UAW, what you're doing this week, I believe. Are you making an exclusive announcement on the Katie Halper Show? Have you announced this yet?
No, I already put it on Twitter the other night. I'll be going tomorrow morning. I would have gone on Monday, but it was Yom Kippur. Today, the president was there. Yes, right back at you. I didn't want it to look today like it was about me and the president being there. That theater is not what's important. What's important here is the UAW. So I will be going tomorrow morning. I read that Trump will also be there tomorrow morning. So that'll be interesting. But I'm not quite sure what's going on because I think he's going. I'll be at a Wayne plant. But I hear that he's going somewhere where they're not actually striking. So I don't know what Trump is doing. But I will be there and I will have the opportunity to talk to workers and to the public about not only why I support the UAW, but also how I recognize that the struggle of the UAW auto workers is no different and is part of a larger picture of a really rebalancing of the American economy. We're living in revolutionary times. I think we're living in a soft revolution already. And I'm reminded of JFK's line that those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And I hope, whether it has to do with the WGA strike, whether it has to do with Amazon, and, you know, I give credit where credit is due. I mean, there are some actions within the Biden administration that are pushing back. And listen, this is not about the horse race. This is about getting things done for the American people. And the fact, this revitalization of the labor movement is absolutely essential. I believe that there needs to be an inside-outside strategy. There has to be a president who is genuinely, in act as well as word, in all ways pro-labor. And there has to be the outside strategy of the labor movement. You see it happening. And, you know, Katie, I'm old enough to remember, first of all, you know, my father was a Detroit labor organizer with the CIO before it was the AFL-CIO. And my brother worked for Cesar Chavez in the late 60s. And I was raised in a home. If you ever cross a picket line, don't bother to come home. That was the home I was raised in. Even though I didn't go to the same camp you went to, that was the kind of home I was raised in. But I am old enough to remember when things started to change in this country. When I was growing up, labor was an indisputable, serious political force. And when Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, neoliberalism, when all of that ascended, the demonization of labor, organized labor, was so much a part of that. That's not to say labor didn't have its own issues at all. However, to watch how they were squashed, how they were demonized and minimized, peripheralized, how the right to work state laws came into being, and now to watch this revitalization is, I think, very encouraging for all of us.
And what do you think of Biden's position on the railway strike?
Ultimately, more than not, he sided with the railroad companies. I think, you know, whether it has to do with that particular strike, whether it has to do with what happened in East Palestine, the tyrannous power. And I do not use the word tyranny lightly, but we are talking about corporate tyranny in many of these cases. And I think that the railroad companies are one of them. Even when Pete Buttigieg went to East Palestine, finally, and he sounded like a whining child. Every time we try to regulate, you won't let us. What is this? Won't let us. I'm so tired, you know, whether it's the Republicans, when they're in power, don't even care to fight. In fact, they're there to enable the corporate powers. But to hear Democrats go, they won't let us, is just enough to make you want to inject them with some spine, which is why I'm running. It's going to take a woman in there, isn't it?
Yeah, perhaps. And certainly a woman who's good on women's rights, as opposed to, say, Hillary Clinton, who, when she was running against Bernie, of course, famously did not support the Fight for 15. And people who care about economics and women's rights know, of course, that most minimum wage earners are women and women of color. So that was an interesting example of Hillary Clinton not actually being pro-woman.
Well, the most important thing we could do to help women right now is something I would do my first day in office, and that's call the archivist and tell her or him to publish the ERA. I mean, that's the quickest, most potent way to close the wage gap between men and women. I mean, that will have an extraordinary economic effect for women, and the president could do that now. Enough states have ratified, the president could call and demand that that be published, and he has not.
Yeah, a lot of people think that the ERA is mostly symbolic, but it actually has...
It's actually not at all. It's actually not at all. It would have a tremendous economic effect. How come you think it's only symbolic? Who came up with that?
A lot of people, I think, write it off as that.
I don't.
So what would the ERA do?
Well, it means that there is no laws that could be passed. I mean, the wage gap between men and women, it will no longer be legal. You cannot have... in fact, many people argue that if we'd gone on and published the ERA, that they could not have overturned Roe v. Wade.
Well, that's another question I have for you. So given how much the Democrats have dropped the ball on Roe v. Wade and how empowered the conservative wing of the Supreme Court is, and one could argue it's just a conservative institution, what would you do to protect a woman's right to choose?
Well, you need to codify, but in order to codify, you're going to need, you know, the power in Congress. That's not something that the president just can come in and make happen. But I don't understand why we are so precious about the filibuster. The filibuster came about in order to protect slave owners and racists. So I don't understand why we're so precious about at least carving out, if not obliterating, the filibuster.
And what about childcare?
Well, in my economic bill of rights, one of the things that we talk about is free childcare. That's what I have. You know, my economic bill of rights, which is an extension really of in the 21st century of Franklin Roosevelt's bill of rights, universal health care, tuition-free college and tech school. Let's cancel the college loan debt. Let's have free childcare. Let's have paid family leave. Let's have guaranteed housing, guaranteed sick pay, and guaranteed living wage. This is the thing, Katie. The ship is listing so far to one side that if you even say, let's put it up just so that it's a level playing field on any way you look at it, just a level playing field for the average American working person. There are elements in this country, including in the Democratic Party, would say, wow, that's so left wing. That's crazy fringe stuff. But actually, everything that we're talking about there is considered a moderate position in every other advanced democracy, including free childcare. I think that the powers of government should be used to help people thrive. You know, people say people want all these free things. First of all, it's not free. It's your own tax dollars. And right now, your tax dollars are going towards corporate subsidies for these huge multi-billion dollar companies who are already making billions of dollars in profit. Often they're making profit doing things that actually hurt people, hurt other species, and hurt the planet. And in cutting the tax rate for all the very richest among us. So this is why a campaign like this matters. We have to just keep saying it. You know, Martin Luther King said, your life begins to end on the day you stop talking about, am I boring you, Katie?
I was just going to say she's going to think I'm yawning. I was about to sneeze and I was covering my nose to sneeze. That's why I muted myself. Yeah. But I didn't sneeze. Yeah.
So, Martin Luther King said, your life begins to end on the day you stop talking about things that matter. The idea that there would not be a presidential candidate in this race saying these things. And to be honest, that there would be people who know that these things are true, who believe these things, who would not be supporting that candidate is pretty shocking to me.
So I just want to say, I mean, I'm torn because I try to ignore the comments, but I want to say something. You and I disagree on certain things, and actually we're going to get to that towards the end of the interview. But something that really does frustrate me in some of the critiques, and I don't even want to give them oxygen, but I will, because this is one of the first things that people were commenting when I tweeted about you coming on the show today. There's this line about you that you are doing this to sell books. And I would just like to, I mean, you can respond to that, but I just want to say something, because I find that to be such a disingenuous argument. And you can have critiques of a candidate and you can have policy differences, but if Marianne wanted to sell more books, she wouldn't be in politics. Like, your books that are very successful financially are not about politics. They're about something else. So I'm just giving you the chance to respond to that claim that that you're doing this to sell books.
Well, I remember when I was on The View in the last election, Meghan McCain and Anna Navarro and all of them were saying she's just doing it to sell books. First of all, every candidate had a book that was about their agenda. That's what you do. I'm sure many people remember Dreams of My Father that Barack Obama had, the audacity of hope that Barack Obama had. That was a good thing. That's not a bad thing. I don't have a political book on this campaign because I had already written that last time. It certainly did not sell books. Although I will point out the one who did have a bestseller based on his book he had at the time was Andrew Yang. Nobody complained about that. I write spiritual books, except the two political books that I'd written, one of which was to explain my agenda, like every other one did, Kamala Harris and everyone else, which is what a candidate does. I make my living, however, writing spiritual books. The way to make money writing spiritual books is to go on a book tour, not a presidential campaign, and you talk about that book. I mean, all those people say I'm selling books. When have I mentioned a book? You don't mention a spiritual book. The way to sell a spiritual book, I can tell you, because I've written a few of them, is to never mention politics. Talking about politics, being in politics, has been actually very bad for my career from a commercial sense. There is someone who worked for the campaign who lost his job, who got on the internet and said, it's just a book tour, folks. This man knows nothing about book publishing. He knows nothing about me, actually. And it's just very sad that people will take a narrative like that, like so many others about me, I might add, and run with it. Tell me what book I'm selling. That's the interesting thing. What book am I selling? Because I don't know. Which book do they think I'm selling? It's kind of like which crystal and which person have I thrown a phone at recently?
All right. That's another one. Yeah. Speaking of which, I want to take it back a little bit, because another thing that you've dealt with are rumors about, like, not believing in medicine and that you're bad on LGBTQ rights. Can you talk about your early days with Project Angel Food?
When my career began, in a way, gay men in Los Angeles gave me my career. And I say that because not long after I started lecturing, the AIDS crisis really burst onto the scene, and I was living in Los Angeles. It wasn't that Western medicine wasn't trying, because it was. It was much like with COVID. People were trying. They were not coming up with anything. The difference, there was a similar panic. The AIDS crisis was a similar panic to COVID, but it was a flip side of it. With COVID, it was very easy to get. But the chances were, if you got it, the chances were you would survive. With AIDS, it was the opposite. It was a difficult disease to get, but if you got it, the chances were you would not survive. So there was great panic. There was great heartache in the air. Because Western medicine, or any medicine, because there wasn't anything, you know, it's, once again, not that they weren't trying, because it took so long for anything to be available. And there was an almost eerie silence on the part of institutional religions who were working through their own homophobia or whatever. And then there was this, at that time, young, I was in my early 30s, woman talking over in Los Angeles about a God who loves you no matter what and about miracles. And it became, my Tuesday night lectures became almost a place where we could all get together, you know, where in the 80s you went clubbing, in the 90s you came to these lectures and went to spiritual support groups and so forth. I certainly never told anyone never to take their medicine. And I'll tell you, at that time, there was no medicine. And when there was medicine, I mean, there's even a video out there of a man talking about how I told a young man at one of the support groups, he said he didn't want to take his medicine. And I said, why don't you want to take your medicine? This was once I was AZT. And he said, well, it'll put me to sleep. And I said, well, you just take your medicine and you fall asleep here at the support group and we'll all be with you, and you'll still hear what we're saying. I raised millions of dollars. I founded nonprofit organizations. Project Angel Food has fed over 16 million meals. It was a Meals on Wheels. I gave book royalties of a very high number. In the Jewish religion, it says to give is good, to give anonymously is better. Somebody has taken one sentence out of my a book about sickness being an illusion. It's the same way. It's in a section which, if you read it, like Buddha says the world is an illusion. Einstein says time and space are illusions of consciousness, albeit persistent ones. The president is a Catholic. President Biden is a Catholic. He has stood up in church many times to say he believes in a virgin birth. Everybody gets it. He understands that there are scientific realities involved in giving birth and conceiving a child. My sister died of breast cancer. I have osteoporosis. To say that I don't go to the doctor or understand the ravages of illness is one of the more vile narratives that has been projected onto me, but there are quite a few of them at this time. So what are you going
to
do?
Someone said in the comments, I'm trying to find it, but someone said, okay, what are we going to do about the people in East Palestine?
Oh, the East Palestine thing is actually getting worse rather than better. One of the first things I would do is officially declare a disaster. You know, in Libby, Montana, because of a disaster that occurred there, the Medicare for All was given. This is what should happen. First of all, we should have universal health care anyway. You know, this is the thing, Katie. The problem with the East Palestine, Ohio, first of all, it's not an accident that Norfolk Southern, that railroad car was through a neighborhood like that to begin with. Because, you know, and with all credit to Obama had tried to regulate those kinds of toxic chemicals. He was not able to. This is why we were talking before about the tyrannous effect of these railroad companies. So what they do is these are basically considered sacrifice zones where people do not have the kind of financial or political leverage to fight back and say, not in our neighborhood. So the biggest problem when something like an East Palestine disaster occurs is that people have no capacity to absorb it. So if you're already living on the edge financially, paycheck to paycheck, if you don't have health care, it's not only the derailment to begin with. In addition to the derailment, there was the fact that then they did the burn-offs that were not permitted. Let me tell you something. Somebody should be prosecuted. I would like to see somebody indicted. Somebody should be tried on criminal charges for what Norfolk Southern did and continues to do to the people of East Palestine. I did a panel the other day. It's going to be on sometime soon with Savage Joy Marie, who I'm sure you know, and some of the people in East Palestine, some of whom I met when I was there. Some of whom were told that their homes are contaminated. They're losing their teeth. They have constant nosebleeds. They have migraines all the time. They are told their homes are contaminated. And then being told by Norfolk Southern, we'll give you $1,000. We'll give you $1,000. How were they ever going to sell their homes? Some of these people's homes were what they, you know, had to save in their lives to have these homes. And also another thing, Norfolk Southern is treating it like we only have responsibility to people a mile out. The problem goes over 7 miles out into Pennsylvania. There are people who cannot go back to their homes. One woman on this panel, they have said, we are going to cover your rent where you are until March of 2024. And then where are these people going to go? They can't go back to their homes. They have been to Washington. They have spoken to senators. They have talked about the fact that they went to talk to senators. And the women on this panel were saying, some of these senators said, we had no idea you were sick. They have gone to the EPA. They recorded a session with the head of the EPA, Michael Reagan, Sherrod Brown. They're not doing anything. They just give these people the runaround. And it's horrifying. And when you ask them, as president, what could I do? Declare a disaster. That's what we need, is for the president to declare a disaster. It's like the president declaring a climate emergency. Once the president does an official declaration of a disaster, then everything that is necessary to actually provide help for these people is automatically provided. The president did come out with an executive order. And the executive order mainly says we're going to collect data. And, you know, my interest isn't in their freaking data. It's in the human despair and the human suffering that is created by these situations. It's horrifying neglect and abandonment of the people of this country that we see in East Palestine. And one of the reasons I hope I win this election is to be able to help them in a way that they are not being helped now. And I can't imagine they're being helped in the future if either Trump or Biden is president inaugurated in 2025.
Yeah, Biden didn't even have the decency to pander to these people by going there.
Where are the votes there?
Right. Disgusting. Someone asked a question that's challenging. Why is she supporting the auto strikes when they are fighting for jobs that make things that affect the climate?
Well, the automobile industry is not going away. The issue is to transition into clean energy, and to including high-speed rail, all of which will have jobs too. The auto workers are not the people who should be paying the price for the fact that we are emitting greenhouse gases and so forth. Now, this is another issue. Of course, one of the things going on there has to do with moving to electric cars. So it is good that they're moving to electric cars. However, the jobs of these people should be protected in the meantime, not just in the meantime, but even going forward. And one of the things that we need, you know, if you look at the tens of thousands of miles of high-speed rail that they have in China, this is not about whether or not there should be a transportation industry. This is about whether there should be a healthy green transportation energy industry, and whether people's jobs are protected, saved, and transformed into the things that will both provide good paying jobs as well as a healthy economy and a healthy, healthy environment for the American people in the years to come.
What about Joseph Biden's position so far on student debt?
Well, some people say that if he had just, at the very, very beginning, I've heard Brianna talk about this, if he had just come in at the very, very beginning and said, cancel all of it, and some people, then they would not have been able to mount the challenge that they mounted. And also, if you talk to the people at the debt collective, he could still use the higher education bill. To me, the important thing on this business about the student loan debt that I want to make clear to the American people, these loans should never have existed. They are an expression of predatory capitalism. That's the problem. You, on one hand, you've got tens of millions of people, right, who are carrying these college loan debts. Still, even with the $10,000 off that he wanted to take, you still got over $1 trillion. You still got over 40 million people who are carrying these. Until the 1970s, we had tuition-free college and tech schools. You have them at in University of Texas, you had them at the University of California, you had them at University of Florida. As a matter of fact, when the newly elected governor of California, Ronald Reagan, came in and smashed that, which was the crown jewel of California, that you could get, you know, I remember Elizabeth Warren used to talk about that, how inexpensive it was for her to get a world-class education when she was in college. That's what made some of the far right-wing forces look at Ronald Reagan and say, ooh, we like him. He's somebody we can use going forward. So the fact that young people who, you know, once again, government, it says in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted to secure the rights, not thwart the rights, not exploit the rights, not suppress the rights, but to secure the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That would be translated into today's languages, self-actualization, spreading your wings. Getting an education is part of that. Government's job is to secure that, not to thwart that. So here are young people, particularly people of color. There's a real racial element with that one, because people of color, particularly young people, were told, get your education. That's how you're going to close the wage gap. Get your education. So now you've got millions of these young people, just because the banks and that malevolent strain of capitalism that puts its tentacles wherever there, it's a heat-seeking missile. Where there's a profit center? Where is there a profit center? Where is there a possible profit center? Its tentacles are anywhere there might be a profit center. And where is there more of a profit center than where people are desperate? That's why that's why we have over a million people rationing their insulin. Why? Because people need insulin. You don't have this in any other advanced democracy where you have universal health care. You talk about rationing insulin, and I spoke at Cambridge not long ago. They looked at me like, you've got to be kidding. They can't even conceive of people rationing their insulin. But let's go back to the college loans. So this is a desperation. I'll get my degree. And everybody listening knows this to be true. So all these kids, they come out of college. And I have to say this, debt is crippling. But to be in your 20s, Katie, carrying tens of thousands of dollars worth of loan debt. And then we wonder where the mental health crisis comes from. Why are people in such anxiety? What do you think? This is so much of it. So you've got these people who come out of school. I talk to them all the time. I have these college loan debts. I got my degree in this. But if I go try to work in the field I got my degree on, I can't imagine ever paying off this debt. It'll take me years to get to the point where I'll even begin to. So I'm going to go work in a field that isn't even what I got my degree for, but where I might be able to get out of debt. So what the hell did I get the degree for? And that's why so many people now are saying, why even go to college? Which is also very bad for this country. So that's why I think that these college loans should be canceled. They should never have existed to begin with. And I would use the full powers of the presidency to make sure of it.
What about your Department of Peace? What would that do?
I think a lot of people don't know that peace building is a thing. It's not just, oh, peace building. It's an actual thing. It's a set of skills. It's an area of expertise. There are four factors which, when present, statistically indicate that there will be a higher level of peace, a higher incidence of peace, and a lower incidence of violence. And this is true whether you're talking about a corner of an American city or you're talking about another corner of the world. Those four factors are higher educational opportunities for children, greater economic opportunities for women, a reduction of violence against women, and an amelioration of unnecessary human despair. Even Donald Rumsfeld, for God's sake, said we need to learn to wage peace. And JFK said, if we don't get rid of war, war will get rid of us. But we have our domestic war zones too. So when I think of a Department of Peace, this applies not only to international situations, but also to domestic situations as well. You know, Martin Luther King said there are two kinds of peace, negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace means there's no outright violence, but there's an underlying tension and anxiety. He said positive peace is where there is, he said that can only be predicated on justice and brotherhood. Just like we have a military academy, we should have a peace academy. And then a military academy, you get your education, but you learn the art of waging war when war is what the country feels it needs. And then you pay your country back by then serving in those wars. That is what a Department of Peace will do. There will be a peace academy and people will be trained. It's taking the Peace Corps to a much more evolved place. Peace Corps is now go there and do what you can. This is, we need to play, just like we have war games, we need to have peace games. We need to strategize. As president, I would want to say, okay, what will it take over the next 100 years? How do we create a world? How do we create a world in which 100 years from now, war will be a memory? Now, some people say that's just completely naive. I say what's naive is to think the species will even still exist on this planet if we don't at least try. So we need to reverse engineer. We're going to have to evolve in ways that are way beyond where we are stuck now. But even that, I want to say something. I saw when I ran for president last time, and I feel it this time, the American people are not the problem. The American political system is the problem because our current political establishment sits on the will of the American people. Our government is essentially a system of legalized bribery, and legislator after legislator after legislator does more to acquiesce and to serve the short-term profit maximization goals of their donors than the express will of the people. The express will of the people is not the problem, whether it has to do with the fact that the majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want universal health care. The majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want tuition-free college and tech school. And I believe that the majority of Americans, you even see that right now, You see that with a lot that's going on. You don't have to be a left winger today to say that the defense budget is too high. So I think that the American people are ready to be led in a far more enlightened direction, including something like a Department of Peace. The problem is not creating the political will. The problem is that we have forces in this country in both parties that do more to suppress the will of the American people than to facilitate its expression.
So what would this Department of Peace do about, let's say, Ukraine?
Well, the Department of Peace would have less to do with what is happening in Ukraine today and more to do with creating situations where there would not have been such a probability that something like Ukraine would even exist. You know, I'm not a pacifist. I do not believe that there is never appropriate need or use for military action. But I see the military like I see a surgeon. If you need surgery, then of course you want to have the very best surgeon. The United States should not only have the very best surgeon, but the very best surgeon on hand. But a reasonable person tries to avoid surgery if possible. Now, I don't think that this specifically has to do with the Department of Peace, but it certainly has to do with who I am and who I would have been and would be as president. I don't think anyone, no matter what your position
is. Sorry, Marianne, I don't mean to cut you off. Can you put down your pen? I'm sorry. That because I know our editor is going to. I'm sorry.
I don't know what I was thinking. No, I'm sorry.
It's just okay. So we can get this out sooner. Yeah.
I don't care what your position is on Ukraine today. I think that all of us can see that there was very irresponsible behavior on the part of the U.S. government poking the bear when it comes to Russia's view of NATO. And I think that that's not specifically related to a Department of Peace per se, but it does have to do with a very different, more sober perspective on the part of the U.S. government and its lack of humility and lack of reasonable analysis, including psychological analysis, towards someone like a Vladimir Putin. They poked him. They poked him. They poked him. And that was more than unwise.
So what would you do now?
Well, you know, I'm an anti-imperialist, and I think if you're going to be against U.S. imperialism, you have to also be against Russian imperialism. That's how I see it. I do recognize the things the United States did wrong in terms of poking the bear. I do recognize, including some fast and loose with NATO that was unwise, the Aegis missiles in Poland, and so forth. I'm not in any way excusing that. However, to me, in my mind, none of that justifies Vladimir Putin's behavior now. I think a lot of what's happening with Ukraine comes down to how you view Putin. Do you think this is all he wants? Some of my friends say, this is all he wants. It's all he wants, and he'll be happy. Just let him have that. I don't believe that. You look at what happened with Crimea. You look at what's happening now. He takes what he wants. He takes a beat. He comes back for more. When you look at Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, when you look at the fact that Finland, which has played this a neutral, they didn't want to be part of NATO, they didn't want any part of it, and now they want to be in NATO. I think that, you know, when I hear someone like Robert Kennedy talk about the humanitarian disaster, which we all see, but he talks as though, let's end the humanitarian disaster. If the United States just pulls out all support for Ukraine, the idea that that would end the humanitarian disaster is absurd. It would begin the next phase of a profound humanitarian disaster when you think in terms of Putin and the basically we're talking about the occupation of Ukraine. That's another thing. I find some people very selective in where they have a problem with occupations. That is an occupation. And that is a grabbing of land and a sovereign country. I know a lot of people, particularly on the left, do not agree with me about this. There has to be a negotiated settlement. That's the only way that this can end. You know, you said to me a couple months ago, talk to Aaron Maté. I called Aaron. We talked for quite a while. And he said to me, we're not that far from each other. We're not. Of course, it has to be a negotiated settlement. That goes without saying. I would like it to be a negotiated settlement when there is still a Ukraine to negotiate.
But isn't there more of a chance? I mean, there is a Ukraine, right? Ukraine exists now. And we know that there would have been a more favorable negotiation earlier, like in April of 2022, which we know Boris Johnson scuttled. So why do we think that it'll get better the longer the war goes on? Or why do you think that, I should say? To hear the rest of my discussion with Marianne Williamson, in which we discuss the war in Ukraine, whether she would run as an independent and or as Cornel West's running mate, please go to patreon.com/thekatiehalper show. And now, here's my discussion on Canada's Ukrainian Nazi problem with Lev Galinkin, Mark Ames, and Yasha Levine. It's a really fascinating discussion, and to hear it in its entirety, which I really recommend, you can once again go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. That's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. We are going to move on to the second segment of the show, and we're going to be talking with Mark Ames of Radio War Nerd podcast, Lev Galinkin of many places like the New York Times and The Guardian and The Forward, and Yasha Levine of The Russians podcast. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Katie?
Good, you?
Good. Lev, Yasha. What's up, guys? Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yasha, you're muted. I think maybe you're afraid that too many Soviet Jews at once.
It's a Jewfecta.
It's good that I was censored, actually, because I was doing a Heil Hitler.
That's never good. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in honor of Canada.
In honor of Canada. Yeah. It's always Canada Day. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys all so much for joining. And I thought, Lev, you could start off by setting up what happened. Because, Lev, you have some recent articles that you wrote at The Forward tracing what just happened in Canada. We also have, of course, video footage. But maybe you could set it up first, then when we can show what actually happened. And of course, when I say what's happened, we're talking about Ukraine Nazi Gate.
Yeah, well, what happened is a bunch of people in Western Ukraine joined Hitler and welcomed the Nazis and formed a Waffen-SS division. And they all had a lot of fun. One of them indeed wrote that it was the best times of his life, 1941 to 1943. Fast forward, and they painted themselves as war victims and as freedom fighters, and Canada took them in with open arms. They continued having fun in Canada. They built monuments to themselves. They had lives. They grew old, and one of them was celebrated 3 days ago in the Canadian Parliament, where he was presented as a fighter against Russia, which he technically was alongside Adolf Hitler and other who fought against Russia. Ivan Kachanovsky, who is a professor from University of Ottawa, he was the first one to report about him on Twitter. And then I was the first one to write a story about him. And eventually things went not as good for him. So right now Poland is thinking of possibly looking into extraditing him for war crimes. And Justin Trudeau issued a half apology before talking about how we need to be careful about Russia, because that's what it's really about, Russia. And the Speaker of the House resigned. And Volodymyr Zelensky, who was there, who was one of the people enthusiastically cheering for him, has so far said nothing at all.
Right. So let's take a look at this. Let's take a look at this speech that the Speaker of Canada's Parliament gave, in which he praises this elderly gentleman. And then we'll take a look at the elderly gentleman. But let's just take a look at the speech first.
Here in the chamber today, Ukrainian-Canadian world veteran from the Second World War who fought the Ukrainian independence against the Russians and continues to support the troops today, even at his age of 98. His name is Yaroslav Hunka. And I was going to say he's in the gallery, but I think you beat me to that. But I'm very proud to say that he is from North Bay and from my riding of Nipissing-Temiskaming.
God, I hope they just play that over and over and over for the rest of my life. you know, that is the only thing that finally burst that Ukrainian, Canadian, emigre, Nazi bubble, because nothing else would do it. It's incredible. Like, there was that pause when he says, and he fought the Russians in World War II, and all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, Russians were allies. But then he just kind of went on, and it, you know, it was just like a slight little brain fart, but they're so deep. I mean, they've been doing this over and over so often that I think that no one expected that this would actually be the thing that got them in trouble, because this has been going on endlessly. I have to admit, I spoke to my sources in Canada, but I was having like back and forth with other people who've been researching this in Canada, who've been extremely frustrated for, you know, many years now about how hard it is to break through into the Canadian discourse. It's like, these are Nazis, you know. But we talked about this, and this was different. And I actually did think this would break, that it had to break through. And I think Lev's article had a big, big influence on kind of pushing the discourse to a new level, because I did notice that when people were calling it out, like on Twitter, normally you have like, you get used to sort of the bot fauna, and the bot fauna, the troll fauna that came into like my replies, for example, was very different than the usual one. They were a little nervous. And then when Lev's piece came out, it was like, what, this is in a Jewish, you know, reputable Jewish magazine.
Or, right, the
you know,
Forward. Media.
Yeah,
right.
The Forward. And that made them even more nervous. And you saw them sort of trying out different narrative rebuttals, like he was only 16 or 17. Yeah, well, when he was, you know, then he wrote that 1941 to 1943 were the best years of his life. And then he joined the Waffen SS.
Volunteered,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, he volunteered. Yeah. But right. It's like, but he's 80 now. And somebody said, yeah, he's only 80 when he wrote that those were the best years of his life, you know? Yeah, I mean, maybe when he's 90.
I mean, look, when you were 16 years old,
he was a naive 80-year-old. He was a babe.
He was talking about his youth in general. He was talking about his youth in general.
A babe in the Nazi woods. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, look, this is the culmination. I think the people who don't really know the backstory to how the Canadian Parliament can actually, you know, bring a Nazi into the gallery and give like a full house standing ovation, like it's the end of like, you know, Phantom
of the
Opera or something, you know, like,
I know. No, that was,
it was like, it was like,
Pope,
please come out one more time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like a full, I mean, it's like what now, I don't know how many years it's been. It's what, 75, it's been at least a 75 year old project, you know, ever since the end of World War II. I mean, a 75 year old project to buy, this Ukrainian community that's been in exile in Canada, that, you know, I mean, not everyone was like a fascist or Nazi collaborator, but the core of that community, like so the brain trust of that community, they were extremely ideological. They were part of this hardcore fascist movement that wanted to create a kind of a version of, you know, what Hitler was doing in Germany. They wanted to create that for themselves in Ukraine. They wanted to create a racially pure Ukraine, free of Jews, free of Poles, free of Russians, and they you know, nearly succeeded, you know, and a lot of these people, either through just as in leadership roles or in actual hands-on experience, ethnically cleansed and genocided Jews and Polish people from the territory of what is modern, you know, Western Ukraine and now. And, you know, even central Ukraine, they went pretty far to the east, you know, and so a lot of these people, the brain trust, found refuge in the West. They found refuge in America. They found refuge in Canada. They found refuge in the UK. And with support from, you know, I won't name these institutions, three-letter agencies, frequently, they had funding from the U.S. government, from covert projects, from the CIA, and they... You know, they didn't need this help, but they had it, and they had their support, and they essentially went on this revisionist. They did this revisionist project where they recast their sort of genocidal fascist political movement into one that was about democracy. One was about fighting communism.
Decolonialism, right? Or decolonization.
Yeah, like that would be called, yeah. They were like, they were trying to decolonize Ukraine from the Soviet Union. And so they were just fighting the Bolsheviks, and they were, you know, fighting not just on the, for themselves, but on behalf of all the enslaved people, you know, of the Soviet Union, for the Latvians, the Estonians, the Lithuanians, the Georgians.
To preserve white Europe. I mean,
they don't talk about that. That's not the rebranded version.
It's not part of the discourse.
It kind of is, but they use slightly different language to protect Europe from the Mongols in Russia, is what they say. Yes. Yeah.
But they recast themselves as this, you know, basically a kind of good Democrats, patriots, anti-communists, first and foremost. And they have been very effective in editing the history of their movements and to the point where someone like in Canada, yeah, I mean, Canada is probably the most extreme version of that, because you couldn't get away with this stuff in America. I mean, you could have, you know, the Prime Minister of Canada, Chrystia Freeland, you know, constantly meet with these Ukrainian groups who are, I mean, they are basically, it's crazy. They're like rebranded logos that they have for themselves. It's like the League of Ukrainian Canadians, for instance, right? Their logo, it has like a maple leaf in the center, and it's kind of this triangle. It is the logo of the OUN, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, that was led by Stepan Bandera, the one that was basically, you know, he is like the Hitler of Ukraine, basically, you know, like the little Hitler of Ukraine. It is exactly the same, except they just stuck a maple leaf on it, you know, and they changed a couple of letters around. Yeah, and then you have, you know, the top politicians from in Canada meeting with them, tweeting about it constantly, and it's in the open, you know, and so you have this Canada is just this really an extreme case of this. It's almost, you know, it's shocking that this is allowed to go on. And I am very glad that this finally happened.
Me too.
I mean, for a lot of us have been writing about this, following this. This is like almost like a cathartic moment because for the first time, it's actually something's.
A lot of us have been keeping each other sane because I would be like, Mark and Yasha, Nazis are bad, right? Like, nothing, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Just checking because I just want to add one. Go ahead, Yasha. Or
No. You please. Yeah, go ahead. I'll interject later.
I should mention, by the way, for people watching, I think I joked about this earlier, but Lev is Ukrainian American Jewish. Yasha, how do you identify? I don't want to put you in a box.
Well, I mean, you know, half of my family, I'd say three quarters of my, yeah, exactly. I'm a born again communist. Yeah. No, but, you know, three out of four of my grandparents come from, you know, Ukraine. You know, I was born in, you know, what is now the Russian Federation. I mean, I was born in the Soviet Union, in Leningrad. So I don't know. I don't know how as a Soviet Jew, as a Soviet American, I don't really know.
And Mark,
California Jew, roots are, I mean, my grandmother's family's from Ivano-Frankivsk, which is now like a stronghold of ultra far right Bandera nationalism, used to be Jewish. And, you know, they were all exterminated at first by Petliuras and, you know, other Ukrainian groups from 1918 to 1921. And then, of course,
I think like 200 survived out of 20,000.
And I'm just a New York Jew with family from Belarusia and stuff. But
I mean, my family, my family, essentially, as far as I can reconstruct some of the history, because this wasn't really talked about in my family. I mean, they fled the famine in Ukraine, from what I can understand, trying to like why they left the shtetl at the time that they left. And they, you know, ended up in Crimea, and they kind of like ran from the famine. And so they were part of the, you know, what's now known as the Holodomor, the famine in Ukraine. Mm. And so they were Jews, and they were affected like a lot of Ukrainian Jews were affected in this famine. Of course, Jews, you know, they were a minority in Ukraine, but they were a large minority. And like everyone who lived at the time during the famine, they were affected by it. And so, you know,
I thought we caused it, Yasha.
It's a typical self-hating Jew. You know, you just famine yourself just because you just hate
people.
Self-famining Jews.
Auto-famine, yeah.
We put ourselves in the gas chambers too.
Self-famining, self-gassing, yeah.
But so we've, yeah. I mean, this is crazy. This story, like you guys are saying, it finally broke through. Lev, what can you tell us about this actual particular Nazi?
Well, yeah. First of all, that's a great question, and I will then proceed to answer the thing that I wanted to say.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, do you want to? No, you go first. Then I forgot. Right. I cut you off with my genealogical. I just realized that people watching may not know that you're a Ukrainian American Jewish journalist, which is.
Two things.
Yeah.
First of all, Yasha has been writing, and he should plug it. He's been writing a phenomenal just history, and it's, I don't even know what it is. It's part memoir, part family history, part just a story about how immigrants are used and are woven into Americans' foreign policy, blah, 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 blah. It's just, it's been fascinating.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much.
One. Two. I don't have the exact info for this, but one thing I found also fascinating is that an ancillary benefit of bringing in these Waffen-SS men was they used them as strike breakers.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah. I wanted to say that to you. No, that's a great point, because we have to remember that Ukraine, so we know the Ukrainian diaspora now is very reactionary, right-wing nationalists. It wasn't like that. I mean, go ahead, Lev, but it's a really important point to make. And there are still a lot of Ukrainians, like especially in Canada, who are angry about this, and they've been key to exposing, you know, for all of us, things like Chrystia Freeland's grandfather. That's thanks to Ukrainian immigrants in Canada. So, yeah.
Well, it's 99% of Ukraine fought against the Nazis. It's like I hate it when Western media is like, these people are seen as heroes in Ukraine. Yeah. They're seen as heroes in the very tiny part of Ukraine.
Yeah,
but they were brought in as strike breakers, because I mean, you have people who need jobs, who are immigrants, who need jobs. You have people who are well organized. You have people who are excellent at carrying out violence and experienced. And you have people who are programmed to hate anything that smacks of socialism
And communism.
Yeah. So
there's specifically communism. Yeah. Yeah.
The what? Yeah.
I mean, because there was a pretty strong communist party in Canada. I mean, the union presence in Canada was very strong. And so they were brought in as like fascists being, again, you know, anti-communist. Yeah. They were brought in as anti-communist muscle to break up the unions. Yeah.
Fascism was violent strike breaking. They evolved from violent strike breaking to a larger program. But yeah.
So don't quote me.
Larger pogrom, if you will.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm surprised none of us has said that we did not see this coming.
I know.
That was good. That made me lol.
So, there were strike breakers, and I think, don't quote me on this, I'm going to do some more research, but I think there's evidence that some Canadian business magnates actually played a key role in bringing them in, specifically for that reason.
That's true.
But the third and the biggest thing that I want to say is, okay, there is these people, Hunka, these people who murdered the Jews and the Poles, and the people in the diaspora who whitewashed them, they are essentially doing their jobs, for lack of a better word.
Yes.
I mean, the people who are whitewashing them, they love them. They think they're great. And they're doing, you know, so they put together bullshit historical narratives and all that part, okay? There is one group of people, one group that was not doing their jobs, and that is the Canadian Jewish organizations for a long time. Okay. These are the people who have large buttons on their websites that says, please give me money to fight anti-Semitism. Okay. And I don't know about Yasha, but I mean, I grew up I was idolizing the American Jewish communities who helped us, who brought us over here out of the Soviet Union. And I had the awakening of my life when I started contacting these Jewish organizations. I'm like, this is happening. These people are on the Nazis. Like, you know, obviously you're going to speak out, right? Like, I was like, they didn't know. And it, you know, the awakening was to find out that they did know. They were just remaining, they were choosing to remain silent.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest, I'll tell you that, you know, I just last month I reported about Philadelphia and monuments in Philadelphia. SS Galician, this unit has monuments in US soil in Detroit and Philadelphia. And the difference, the biggest difference out of everything, is that the Jewish groups in Philadelphia, the regional Jewish groups, were like, holy shit, this is awful. And they started speaking out. That was the one, the people who were supposed to do their job did their job. Okay. And finally in Canada, like, it's like the emperor's new clothes. You know what I mean? Like Jewish groups spoke, the people who are supposed, they did their job. And that was like the biggest thing ever. And the silence before it to me was one of the most shameful things imaginable.
Lev, actually, I wanted to ask you about this because I was following the story and you were writing about it, obviously, the you know, about the monument again to the SS, right? To the Ukrainian SS division. There's a monument to it in Philadelphia. And it isn't just the Ukrainian, it has also the UNA logo on it, right? Which is the Ukrainian national what is it?
It's
the UNA. It's Ukrainian National Army.
At the very end of the war, they were briefly renamed into
themselves. Yes, yeah. They rebranded for the coming kind of like whitewashing of their movement.
It conveniently does not have the attention grabbing SS. So.
No. They called it the Ukrainian Division.
SS, yeah.
And they called it the Ukrainian Division, you know, which is, you know, they rebranded themselves at the very end. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was interesting because I was following it. And let me ask you this. Do you think actually, because these are big or Jewish organizations that actually said, hey, what the hell, Philadelphia, like, why is there, you know, a monument to an SS division here in our backyard? I mean, these are big Jewish organizations. I mean, one of them is the Jewish Federations, right? The Jewish Federation of Philadelphia, which is part of the larger Jewish Federation's sort of umbrella group, which is, you know, like kind of like, you know, I don't know, like it brings together all of these regional foundations in America, very powerful group with a lot of money and a lot of influence. And then there's also the another group that
American Jewish Committee and the AJC.
Yes, mm-hmm. The AJC came in, which is another big, big one. Do you think it'll actually have an impact? Because I feel like, okay, they protested, they did their thing, but like, it ended there, you know. It just seemed like it ended there.
Well, it didn't. I'm working on a piece that's going to come out tomorrow, but in the meantime, it's been boarded up. The monument has been boarded up.
Yes,
and
I saw that.
Other people covered it with a Ukrainian flag and put flowers on it. So it's been
So there's like a little war that's going on.
You know, it's like when the Jews make you board up your monument, but you still want to show love.
I hate when that happens.
Zelensky should travel there and put some flowers on there.
Yeah. What do you guys think? What is the backstory here? You have this Canadian, like very, very goyish Canadian guy, right? Saying, like praising this Nazi. Does he not know? Does he know, but he thinks it's politically expedient? Like what happens here? How did this happen? Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time!